This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 331 of the Outlander podcast. I am still Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode, we'd like to thank co-producer Anna L.
And now, on to our discussion of episode 506, Better to Marry Than Burn.
Yet again, a number of times, I think at least once before this one, if not twice, we get the previously on Outlander, get some intro music. The only thing I have to say about it is it's grown on me so much, I really love it now. So I really like it. Then we go into the opening title. For the opening title, we have The Dandy Getting Ready.
Whiskey and wig powder is what I wrote.
It was a lot. It was more than enough. It had been, I know it was only one season ago, but when we got the up close and personal with that dandy, it was like shocking. He has such bold masculine features that with the dandy makeup and everything, it almost it's gonna sound really weird. It almost looks like he's in drag. I guess it kind of is.
When I saw the title card, I was not 100% sure who I was looking at first, because I thought it could have been Tryon, because he did show up not remotely dressed in his Redcoats uniform. But we also got Wiley back.
So I have been hoping and waiting. Hoping for this. And in a pretty decently, definitely long enough, but in a short and sweet, very bittersweet. No, there's no sweet about it. In a very short, bitter, sad scene, we got a tremendous amount, more than ever, of Jocasta's backstory.
And I want you to know that the second I saw that coach,
the carriage showed up.
Oh yeah, I was like, oh, it's Jocasta's backstory. It's Jocasta's backstory. It's happening. It's happening.
Yep. And as soon as I saw it, I said, oh my gosh, because I knew what was coming. And oh yeah,
it's dreadful. I didn't have tears immediately, but I did know exactly where it was going.
So we are in a carriage. We see a carriage. It's Scotland, 1746. So you know, even if you're not a book reader, that this is, you can surmise, it is at least the same year as Culloden. Now, Jocasta and Hector Cameron are with their daughter, Morna, and they are like a bat out of hell riding that carriage. And they get stopped just after Culloden, and they get stopped by some British or government dragoons. Long story short, because a lot of stuff happens, you can read the script, but by the time this comes out, the script will be out soon. Even though they do their best to hide the gold, they almost got away with it, but when the dragoon bends over to help Morna out of a mud puddle ocean, deep mud ocean, he sees a little like casket, like a basket.
Strongbox. Which it seemed to me like that was really an obvious place to stick it. Like it looked like a place where you would stick a strong box. So it didn't seem like a great hiding.
The only thing I didn't remember was, because this part was pretty ding dong straight from the book. The one thing I don't know honored, that sounds bad, that I don't think it was the same is I thought the gold was like in the floor of the carriage. I didn't remember it being like on the outside underneath, because I agree. I think that would be a little too easy to see for the eyeballs. So the dragoon finds the gold. He calls it French gold. He says the French king symbol, which is the fleur-de-lis.
Yeah. And I saw that and I was like, I said, Frenchman's gold, we're doing this. I guess we're doing this. We're all in.
We'll talk about that in just a second. As spoiler-free as possible, because it's hard to talk about it without talking about it. So they find the gold, the French gold, and it's marked with the fleur-de-lis. And in some order, Hector shoots one of the dudes. The driver shoots one of the dudes. And it was Hector's shot, however, that killed his daughter, Morna. And of course, Jocasta is, they're both affected by it. But Jocasta is there solely as wife and mother, or mother at that point. And her mama heart is just like, it's done. And Hector For good or for ill, you can totally bash him for it and you wouldn't be wrong. But Hector, for good or for ill, has his thing, and thank goodness, has enough wits about him, even in this really awful, awful, awful scenario, that he gets his wife back on the thing, they get back the gold, and the driver gets him away. Because if they had stayed, or if they had tried to go, you know, what are you going to do? You don't have a hoe or a rake or a shovel. You don't have anything to bury your daughter. What are you going to do? Like, there's literally nothing you can do. And you have to get a move on because you will be stopped again and you will probably be killed next time. So much to talk about.
Having shoveled a lot over the last 7 days, a hoe is not the implement I would use to bury anything.
A shovel.
Yes, but you said a hoe.
I said a hoe and a shovel and a rake and a shake. Come on.
Okay, I wouldn't use a rake either.
Well, obviously, they're all garden implements. Really quickly, well, I don't think now is the time to really, even without spoiling, talk about the gold, because it comes up again later. So we'll talk about it a little bit later when What's Her Name talks about it. So then we go back to River Run. It's present day, quote unquote, which is us in the 18th century. And it's the night before Jocasta's wedding to Duncan Innes. Can I ask you a question? I've even looked at her Instagram account and I haven't seen anything of Natty Palm, whatever her name is. Where's Phaedra?
I don't know. Maybe she's busy.
That's her body servant.
I'm more concerned with the fact that I did not imagine Duncan Innes being this elderly. Like, really elderly.
Yeah, that was interesting. And he seems to kind of have money, which is fine. That's fine. He also seems to be not one arm, but maybe half arm. He's got a bicep.
He's definitely missing a hand. That's as far as I'd go.
That's been done. That's so like two seasons ago, because you don't need to have two people without hands, because Fergus got that covered.
No, and to be fair, this whole scene made me think to myself when she was having her interaction with Duncan Innes, is I was thinking to myself, I personally would be the worst blind person, because if I don't see my face on a regular basis, I have no concept of my resting bitch face. And I would just be in trouble all the time.
I kind of felt bad. I felt bad for both of them. I felt bad for her because she's not a love match. I felt bad for him because it's not a love match. And he knows this, but also because she was giving him all kinds of lip. So, and not in a good way.
It's not a love match, and she's giving River Run away to somebody else. Like, she's clearly like, I'm outliving you because I've outlived everyone else I've ever been married to, and you don't get it when I die.
Yes and no, but we'll get to that later as well. So Innes brings her a present. He's really trying to be nice. God bless him. And unfortunately, she's just not having it. She's like, she takes it. She says thank you, but she's like, he tries to like talk a little nicey-nicey, and she's like, thank you. I mean, she cuts him off.
Goodbye.
Exactly. And Ulysses to the rescue. And then it's basically, oh yeah, we got to go. Ulysses says, Mr. Forbes and Jamie, your nephew are downstairs. She says, I believe to Ulysses, because there ain't no one there right now. Happiness doesn't come into it. In time, Mr. Innes may afford me a bit of peace. So downstairs, it's official. They're signing the will. I believe it's the will. Wee Gem is officially Jocasta's heir. Jocasta and Jamie sign the document.
How pissed off are Roger and Bree?
Oh, well, when we get to them, you can tell me.
Well, I mean, they don't know. They're not there. But I'm thinking, how pissed off would you be if you made it very clear that you were not interested? But he told her, don't. And you can't. We won't take it. We don't want it. But to have them do it anyway.
Yeah, that's a whole who knows? We haven't heard them. Well, we haven't heard them in the show yet. And before we go back to the ridge we learn a very important piece of information. So by her giving the property, or willing the property to Jem will be the new master. So I'm guessing it wasn't even a will. It was like a transfer, right? Because he was the master, because she said, because she's running River Run in his absence, which means sure, he's the master.
Like it was a trust.
It takes it away from Innes. Innes is not the active. Innes will be part of it, obviously, as Jocasta's husband. But he may be thought of as a master, but I believe, and we'll see if I'm right or wrong, I believe the show is putting Jocasta, keeping her at the helm of River Run. In the book, it's slightly different. I believe she does make Jem the heir, But again, because the whole, there is no Murtaugh past Culloden. So that's a whole different ball of wax. But in the books, Duncan Innes was in Ardsmuir, right? So he was one of the Ardsmuir men. And he came over, like he went to, he was in Jamaica with them. So he was part of the story right from the get-go when we revisit Jaime, or at least when they get ready to go to the Indies. So anyway, that's a whole other discussion too. So we get to the ridge. Roger and Brianna stayed at home, we learn. Jem has a cold. Roger insists, I cannot speak. It's quite late. Roger had wanted to, he says, I wanted to stay home and help out with the baby. I was like, she's like, I can handle the cold and a baby at the cold.
Yeah, but he wouldn't have gone without her. That would have been weird.
Oh, sure. He also wanted to insult Jocasta by not attending her wedding after, as Summer said, her having insulted him at their wedding. So that's kind of interesting, because in the book you had, you know, it was still two weddings, but it wasn't. It was at the gathering rather than
the actual wedding took place later and they were there.
The only glimpse we get of Wee Adso this episode is when the camera shows us Adso playing with a little locust or a little grasshopper.
I believe they're in the same family, but they're definitely, locusts are bigger to my understanding.
Ah, locusts and grasshoppers are the same in appearance. So they do look the same. But locusts can exist in two different behavioral states, solitary and gregarious, whereas most grasshoppers do not. While the population density is low, locusts behave as individuals, much like grasshoppers. I don't need to read anything more because I'm literally like, I'm already falling asleep. So they have a locust, or are getting, these are the warning locusts, right? These are like the ladies in waiting, or the what do you call it? The messenger locusts. They go out in front.
It's the beginning of the plague of locusts.
The plague. This is taking the place of a fun scene, or what is to come is taking the place of a fun scene in the book where Claire and Brianna actually burn a field to keep locusts from spreading because they've already landed. So it's pretty much a switcher, right? A switcheroony. It's like one, like everything worked out in the show the way they did it. Everything was fine. You know, they didn't even have to keep the locusts, but by having, again, by compressing time and keeping them apart and not going to the wedding like Jaime, just having Jaime and Claire go to the wedding, they're there. They have to, you know, give them something to do. Bring in the locusts and you don't have Brianna and Claire and I think maybe someone else, but at least Brianna and Claire running around in their shifts when the newcomers led by Roger, their token-ish Protestant with Hiram Crombie, I believe, walking up the ridge, seeing this scene, because that's how it happens in the books, like great first impression, right? So we don't have that. We kind of started season five kind of already started with, we've got those settlers already. I don't know that it's been, except for the minister they had at the wedding, I don't know that it's been explicitly stated that they have a mixture of Protestant versus Catholic settlers. Maybe it has. I don't remember. In the book, it was a little bit bigger deal was made of it as far as them coming in. But it was their literal arrival. Roger had been sent to go meet them and bring them up because he was a fellow Protestant. It was obviously a better decision to send him than to send Jaime. So anyway, that, which was hecka funny, right? Because it looks like here are these really strong, devout Protestants, you know, very anti-popish. And they come up the ridge and they see these two female papists, half naked or mostly naked, running around with a fire, like hooting and hollering. I mean, come on. It was like, it's just like, it's feeding their anxiety. It's too funny. So that was slightly changed, but it totally worked because in the end what it did, and I'm really summarizing this, but even though there's more to talk about, it gave Roger and Bree and the whole ridge, basically, it gave us a reason to stay on the ridge, right? And it also gave Roger a task. That is basically the difference between the show and the book in that. Back at River Run, Murtaugh, and I don't know why that I am not surprised. Murtaugh is not at the wedding. And I thought, why would he be? The governor is there, dude. Murtaugh's not stupid. Although he shows up later, so maybe he is.
I was more concerned about the fact that it looked like it was France. Like, everything about this wedding looked like France.
Oh, because of all the fanciness?
Mm-hmm. And I want to know where they rented that pergola from, because I don't think they have wedding rentals back then.
Oh. Oh, you know, she had it built.
By John Gary
Steele. It's John Gary Steele of the 18th century. Claire looks beautiful, and we see for a little bit. We see. I was disappointed we didn't see much of Lord John, but we saw a little bit. All the single ladies wanted him. I mean, when do they not? I mean, if he wanted them, he could have a ton of ladies, but obviously that's not his thing. And it's time. And after that, they chat a little bit and they're like, oh, it's time to go worship the governor now. Tryon is a bit of a D.
He just was setting himself up like he's his own little king. Because he was like, oh, no, you're going to call my wife Her Excellency.
That was a bit much. And then even she's like, yeah, you don't have to. It was a bit much. We find out that they're leaving. And the governor introduces them to a judge, Martin. I think I have the name right. Martin Atticus. There's some troublemaker in the background kind of fight. And it's the guy's name is thrown out. Quincy Arbuckle is there kind of making a disturbance. And then they talk about a recent legislative victory, which we learned of last episode, which was the governor offering a pardon to dishonorable men. And he thought that Knox might be with him there at the wedding. But sad times, of course, Knox is gone. I don't know if it was covered last episode. It may very well have been. But at least in this episode, Tryon says something of the... to the point of him having mercy, or him showing mercy, is allowing the men by a certain day or time, or maybe that day, to have turned themselves in. And then they would, I don't know how they'd be treated, but they could turn themselves in. And we find out the result of that and what happened and the penalty for that, the repercussions, at the very end of the episode. I like Mrs. Gov. And then she and Claire, they bugger off. And we hear the first mention of a game of high stakes whist. Back on the ridge, there's even more bugs. People want to burn Mr. Fraser's field and be done with it. And Captain Roger maintains control, warns of the danger of fire, homes could burn, etc. And of course, all the dudes, and probably the women too, if they were allowed to speak. I wish Colonel Fraser were here. He'd have an answer.
No, I mean, this is Roger's chance, man, to like prove himself.
To not sing.
Right?
The first time I watched it, I was like, oh, he looks not very happy. And the second time, like, I like downright guffawed. If you, at this scene, Fergus is at a corner, like sitting, like leaning against a wall or leaning against a window. And he just looks so, not pissed, just like disgusted. I'm like, that made me laugh because he's got like no lines. He's just sitting there. And I was just like, oh, poor Fergus. Back at River Run, Claire sees Philip Wiley arrive via like a mock gondola. Seriously. He's that. And then I had forgotten now the dude, Summer pointed him out months ago. The dude who plays him, or maybe a year ago, he's very attractive.
It's a smoke show.
Right? He is okay. He's a smoke show. In his dandy getup.
Awful.
I'm sorry. He's hideous.
Blech.
I mean, that's what I'm saying. They did a good job with the makeup because he's not attractive. He's gross. I mean, the way he acts is gross too, but the way he's made up is not okay. And he is, I've never heard that. I'm gonna use that. I like that. He is a smoke show. He is a hottie patat. So the way he gets off the gondola or the canoe, whatever, that he's being rowed in, and the way he walks with that stick cane, it's just like, it's like, put it out, one foot, the next foot, look to the left, look to the right. I'm like, what are you, really? You're such a production, as the Germans, or at least in my experience, the Swiss would say, was für ein Theater. What kind of drama are you making? What kind of theater are you making? This is ridiculous. What did you think when you first saw him walk?
I thought his strut was kind of awesome, but you know, the closer you get, it's like in the movie Clueless, where they called somebody a Monet, where from far away they look really good, but up close it's a big mess.
Oh, his walk just made me want to gag. I mean, his face did too, but his walk was like, oh, really? Thankfully, Mrs. Gov saves Claire for now. And then when Claire walks around a little bit by herself, she almost runs into some women on a bench chatting of Dr. Rawlings, and Claire chats them up a little bit. They're not amused. And then she runs into Wiley again.
Well, it was more than that she was just not amused. It was like the fact that people are using this article to say, you can't sleep with me during this week of the month is never going to go over well with the menfolk, one. Two, she totally inserted herself into their conversation and then excused herself like she was invited in the first place.
I think we have to be ready. The only thing that kind of not upsets me but worries me about this storyline is not that it's injecting potential danger for her, because that's obviously, I mean, first of all, she's Claire, a chaos monster. It happens everywhere in any way. But one of the things Diana does, you can say she repeats a lot of things or whatever. Yes, Claire always has the potential to, you know, she rides that fine line of like science and magic as far as people of the 18th century are concerned. And she has to be careful with what she says and how she, what she does in front of people and et cetera. But it's because of Cranesmere, like it never freaking goes away. In the book, like she even thinks about it in book 8. It comes up. It is not. That is like her, well, other stuff happens in another book, but until that other thing happens in another book, Cranesmere is her one, besides, you know, losing Jamie and then finding him, and then before she finds him again, it's her biggest, Faith's her biggest, probably the biggest tragedy, right? Before, besides losing Jamie, but her near death at Cranesmere is the thing that has shaped her negatively or affected her, you know, emotionally, scarred her the most outside of, you know, the whole Jamie thing, which is obviously big. And by that, I just mean, in the book, it's always in her memory and there's always that potential danger. And right as she gets close to a line or has a thought of something, Diana will write something about, oh, you know, that was too close for comfort. You know, I know to stick away from this kind of stuff. So it's like she goes up to the line and never, and doesn't cross it. And so all of this to say that at least thus far, Diana has not put Claire in another situation where she might be burned for witchcraft or something along those lines. Because in something else does happen in the books, and we'll see how it's handled in the show. That is not, it's not related to any kind of, you know, metaphysical potential magic witchcraft, nothing like that. That's only Cranesmere that so far. So the reason I say all of that is not fear, but my only concern in the book, when you have like all this potential, because it's being telegraphed like a mile away, right? When you have, first it was in Brownsville, now it's in River Run. When the more you have these little pipings up of people talking about Rawlings, and you see how far the writing has gotten, to me, that signals there's going to be trouble for Claire, and it's going to have to do along the lines with maybe not magic. I'm sorry, it's too close to Cranesmere. And so I think it's a good, interesting plot line. But how do you feel about that, Summer? If it goes to where I think they're leading us potentially, and of course, we don't know where it's going to end up. It just seems it's awfully similar-ish to the path to Cranesmere.
Anything that points her out as being other is dangerous. So we'll see. I don't know.
If it's in any way similar to what I think it might be, or in any way similar to the witchcraft plot or the Cranesmere thing, it's been done. Different circumstances, different country, different continent, different year. It's still been done. So we don't know for sure. We will find out. But I'm just afraid they're repeating something, which to me sounds like they didn't have a better idea. But as far, whatever that far off thing is, we don't know. But as far as the hinting and as far as using, you know, something that the character legitimately would do, which is writing those things down. I don't think it's genius. I think it's a good idea. What they've done makes sense. And even though it's new, it's not in the book, it is something that is extremely plausible thus far. I'm just afraid if it takes the same path as the other thing, it's like it's repetition, and it shows lack of creativity as far as a potential way to get her in trouble. Not the way, excuse me. The way is different, but the content is very similar, and what she would potentially be in trouble for is very similar. But we shall see. Back on the ridge, Roger comes up with the idea of smoking locusts to drive them away. Let's try it. Look at those people on the ridge working together.
Yeah, I just felt bad for him because I feel like he keeps comparing himself to Jamie, and that's short-sighted. He shouldn't have to do that. And I also noted that this will be the episode with the image of Roger and Bree from the back from the opening credits. If you're looking for a fun way to pass the time while engaging your brain and enjoying breathtaking visuals and a gripping story, your answer is Best Fiends.
Best Fiends is a casual game that anyone can play, but made for adults. You can spend as much or as little time as you like in the game. I'm currently on level 102. Now, one thing I've noticed since our last visit from Best Fiends is that I took your suggestion, Summer, and I have started playing it more while waiting in lines, in doctor's offices. And I know I started this last time we were visited by Best Fiends, but I've done it even more. Matter of fact, I was at the doctor's office today and I waited a half an hour and I took it out. It is so easy to get lost in. I still love the bright colors. It's very well designed and I love it visually. How about you, Sam?
Well, I mean, I'm not trying to brag, but I'm currently on level 522.
Yes, you are. Stop it.
But my favorite thing about Best Fiends is that they update the game monthly with new levels and events so it never gets old, and they treat the game like a service for their players. It doesn't feel like there's paywalls. You know what I mean? You can play it 100% from the beginning to the end of time and never have to drop cash on it if you don't want to. I mean, you could if you wanted to, I suppose, but I have been enjoying my free download of Best Fiends since we started playing it. And those little tiny insecty creatures are my favorite. I love evolving them. I love upgrading them. I love seeing what cool little tricks they do. It has just been such a great little adventure that doesn't eat my data.
Engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters. Trust me, with over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is a must play. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play.
That's Friends without the R. Best Fiends.
River Run, Jamie and the Gov. This new act that was passed will arrest anyone who was present in Hillsborough. They must submit themselves. And he reminds Jamie, or they remind each other, there's the law and there's what is done. And we find out that he had been offered the governorship of New York. So this explains why the need, at least two reasons for why he's so bent on getting these regulators, squashing this soon, like yesterday. And those two reasons are, if he's about to take on another assignment, why would he want the regulator thing cleaned up?
So that it's not something that hangs over him?
Pretty much. Yeah. So because whoever's incoming, he doesn't want to... I don't believe this is why, but you could do it and claim it and no one really can prove you otherwise. But there's the humanitarian side of him, or the mensch side of him, quote unquote, that is like, I don't want to leave this for my colleague to have to clean up. That's not very nice or professional of me to leave that for the next person. Well, okay, on the outside, that's a very legit reason, right? But then there's also, if he couldn't get his ducks in a row and clean this up before he goes on, by getting it done, it looks and is better for the incoming governor. But it also looks better on him that he has one more notch in his belt to say what he did, another accomplishment before going on. So it's kind of self-serving, right? Because it shows good on him in his line of work, but also getting this done quickly. I think the speed that he wants it done is because he's leaving so soon. That is, to me, is the speed. But also what that puts pressure on is he wants it done before he leaves, but I'll be damned if I'm going to let these people get away with this, and I'm leaving soon, so we have to do this soon. So it's, I think, a lot of pride. Professional and personal pride. I think it's mostly those two things. Back on the ridge, Roger shows us all the pots they're collecting, and he's filling them with shite. That was kind of gross. He calls them smudge pots, and he fills them with dung and oil. Now, I wonder if they'll let us know if they really used poop. I mean, they could easily use like peat or mud. Oh, because maybe it was too flammable.
I mean, in real life, I'm sure that's just stinky. Why would you do that to somebody?
To work with, or just stank?
They're not that method.
Of course it's stinky, but they're method. Come on. I don't know if they're method. That's not true. I don't know. So there's a new problem. Once they figured out they're going to do smoke, another problem is, how are we going to move it in the direction we want? Brianna sees laundry hanging to dry and has an idea. Back at River Run, Abigail hasn't seen Jamie. Now, what does that mean? Jocasta asks Abigail where Jamie is. Or is it, I guess it maybe, no, sorry, it's Claire. Claire asks Abigail. Who is Abigail, you might say? I don't know, the stand-in for Fedra. She's everywhere. I believe Abigail was also with Jocasta earlier. Anyway, I don't know. But Fedra's missing, and that's not a good thing. Abigail hasn't seen Jamie. Claire runs off trying to find Jamie, and she runs into Wiley. He tells her of his Chantilly lace that he brought for Jocasta from France. Quote, if you knew the right people, you wouldn't be languishing in the backcountry. Unquote. And he's just talking and gabbing, and he says that he knows an Irish smuggler in Wilmington. Now that piques her interest. They go back and forth, and she says, whiskey, he likes it. He asks about her rings. She lets him know that one is for her previous husband who died a lifetime ago. I thought that's a good answer, because how do you answer?
200 years from now?
He's not born yet? He's surprised that Jamie lets her wear another man's ring. And then she goes in. It's a matter of business, this Irish dude. Can you help us get around some financial inconveniences for this, like, a whiskey biz? And he mentions Mr. Bonnet. And he says, the dandy says, he won't do business with people he doesn't know. And Claire's like, that's no worry, because only you'll do business with him. And of course, you'll take your part of the profit. And the dandy makes no promises. And then he says, you've shown me yours. Now I'll show you mine, before getting ready to go see Lucas. Back on the ridge, people are getting ready for smoking. Josiah is helping out. I don't think we saw Kezi this episode, just Josiah. And or maybe we did, and I just don't recognize him because he's not in a shirt anymore. I only recognize Kezi when he's half naked. And this is also the scene that we have of them. And I think this is what Summer's talking about. When they have all the smoking out, they're getting ready for the locusts to come. And we see Roger and Bree from the back. Yeah, this is the scene from the intro. Or it's that scene from the intro. Back at River Run, Wiley shows her his. His Lucas, of course. Now, that was a beautiful horse. I'm not sure. I think in the book, wasn't it a Frisian?
I think it was a Frisian. A black
something. It was beautiful. Big, beautiful horse. The horse was big, black, and beautiful as well. I don't know if the exact breed was the same, but it doesn't matter. It was big. And then she's like, oh, how beautiful. This is so sweet. Da, 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 da. And he's behind her talking to her. She thinks he's talking, like agreeing with her, talking about the horse, but he's talking about her. And then he goes in for the cuddle.
That was not a cuddle.
She shoves him into the poo.
He attacked her.
I know. Of course he did. He assaulted her. Yes. And she shoves him in the poo. There's lots of poo this episode. Poo on both ends. First in the ridge and then a River Run. And then like 2 seconds. So he stands up and he's about to go after Claire when Jamie magically appears. And the dandy tries to defend himself. He says, she plied me with drink and then practically begged me to.
Yeah, I was like,
I can't with that dandy.
I was like, calm down. Because I'm like, and then he was like, you wouldn't kill somebody at your aunt's wedding. And I was like, didn't you see the last episode?
Summer and I, and this is totally fine, because it's, we all see it differently and we have different opinions, right? There was a lot of feedback to our posts that we had posted in the posting area. Oh my gosh. A lot of feedback to our various posts on Facebook about our last episode, 330, that Summer and I both agreed, if I'm not mistaken, that Jamie's killing of Knox was out of character. Not because Jamie doesn't kill, not because Jamie doesn't take oaths, not because Jamie doesn't protect people, but because no one, not even Jamie, was imminently about to die right there. And the character of Jamie is very linguistically gifted. That dude, of course he can fight, but he can also talk his way out of almost anything. So it's not that Knox didn't need to die. It was a lot. Summer, at the base of it, Summer was right. Like, this is what happens when Murtaugh lives. Mm-hmm. All those things, it had to be wrapped up. Yeah, so I thought it was funny, and I was immediately reminded of Knox's murder, because this is Jamie protecting his family, right? This is Jamie protecting his family. This is his oath to protect his family. Him killing Knox was, I think ultimately, unfortunately, it was potentially unavoidable, but...
That was a lot of adjectives.
Yes. Actually, a lot of adverbs as well. So he tells him, go away. You try it again. I'll kill you. And he does. Goes over to Claire. He picks off the dandy's beauty mark from her neck.
That was gross.
And she tells him he knows Bonnet.
I don't know why that was so gross, but it was gross.
Also at River Run, Jamie remarks that the dandy likes to gamble. Back at the Ridge, the residents are working together to fan the fires. Well, they are fires, but mostly move the smoke to the fields. We see a huge swarm of locusts a-coming, and they're successful. Hooray, the swarm passes. River Run. Jamie goes to the dandy, and he wants to enter the big game.
Whist.
Or actually, right then, he wants to play with him right there.
Don't say play with him. That sounds naughty.
Summer, stop. Jamie says... Play me now. If I win, you will leave now. And if you win, what did he say? What were the stakes? Not the big game, the one he wanted to play. Okay, so me either. So Jamie comes to him individually and says, I want to play a game with you right now, a card game, whatever. If I win, you leave. If you win, then something. You guys can fill in the blanks because I don't have it in my...
He takes his horse?
Oh, basically... Oh, if Jamie wins, then we'll tell... I think he said, I'll tell Tryon about everything you've done or, you know, everything that, you know, all about you. And his response is basically, joke's on you. My reputation precedes me. I got nothing to hide. I'm a known quantity. You tattling about me to anyone is not gonna hurt anything. And they say one game. And
but you need more than this.
So after Jamie goes to Claire for the rings, we go back to the Ridge, and it seems that the swarms of locusts have passed. And they only lost a little bit of, I think, Fraser's mm-hmm. Field or some other stuff, but they're gonna be okay.
Did you hear what was saved? Corn. And then I thought Dougal would be so proud.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Don't you remember him as Corn Grinder? He was corn grinding.
People are starting to call him Captain Mackenzie, and it seems like I don't want to say faith is restored because I don't know if they ever had faith for him, but it's at least beginning to become established.
Well, respect is earned.
Yeah. Yeah, probably respect is a better... Well, I think faith too. Respect and faith are beginning. Back to River Run. That rented France, as Summer said, is beautiful. It's even more gorgeous at night with all the right. candles and the lights, obviously, because they didn't have... officially, they didn't have electricity back then. Still don't know why we're not still don't know why we're not seeing Phaedra. So I'm surprised we haven't heard anything. If they weren't going to use the actress for some reason, surely they would have recast her. But since they haven't reached out, I mean, I don't know. I do say I looked at her Instagram timeline, and the last time she shared anything of like, you know, a cutesy shot of herself in costume was from 2018, so probably just before season 4 came out. But anywhoozle, we'll hopefully find something out. So Ulysses, it's nighttime. Jocasta's in her room, and Ulysses brings in Murtaugh.
Grumble. That made me so angry, that whole scene.
and Murta brings her a gift. Why does that make you angry?
Well, it just upset me because this is all the course correction that they're having to do to make him make sense in this storyline. And I don't like how it makes Duncan Ennis not worthy. I don't like how it makes him seem like he's a second choice or just a backup plan. I don't like how he told her to go do it, and now he's showing up and saying, wait for me on her wedding night. I don't like it. I don't like what it's turned Murta into.
And I think it was a bit selfish, don't you?
Totally selfish. Who does that? You don't do that. I'm like, you're too late.
That was not about her. That was about him.
Yeah, and I feel like the Murta that survived Culloden is a bit of a tool.
I don't know that you'll have a ton of people who necessarily disagree. You will have people who disagree, but yeah, it's all over the place. When she knows it's him and she stands up and she puts her hands on his chest and he takes her hands, those are the hands. So I definitely was wrong. Those are the hands that we see in the intro, the faceless hands, the hands up against someone's shirt.
Yeah. We got so many intro shots from this episode.
We did. At least two, if not three. So Murta basically asks her to wait for him. I don't think she said the words, but I was like, until when? The answer that was not spoken is until this craziness is over.
Well, but then she's like, you know, that this whole regulation thing is over. And she's like, yeah, but then there'll be another war and another war and another war. What is, you know, you either basically get off the pot and you already got off the pot. So get out of the way.
He says, I didn't think you'd say yes. And I'm guessing he means to Ennis. And or maybe to him. But anyway, she says no to him, no to Murta in waiting. And she says, I'm sorry. And then she picks up the ribbon. We don't get a tight shot of it, but it looks like she's about to pick up a ribbon. And my guess was it was that ribbon of her daughter's. And then she goes on to, you know, we get more of her backstory connecting to that opening scene with the carriage, the runaway carriage. So she says, she wants a man whose only cause will be my happiness. He reminds her of the Mackenzie motto, I shine, luceo non uro, I think. I think I have that right. I shine, not burn.
I shine, not burn.
Yeah. And then she tells him her story of after Culloden. It was her and her daughter. Of course, Hector, too.
Well, that was before Culloden. Wasn't that before Culloden? Weren't they leaving?
No, with the gold, that was after. Okay, it may have been around the time of Culloden. I take it back. Because we're not given a month. The only thing we have, which could have been just words. Although the fact that he knew about it makes me think it was. So in the opening scene, Hector says something about Culloden. So for him to have known about the fight, it's either because he knows where the location is, but maybe it hasn't happened yet. But I'm pretty sure it's after Culloden. But either way, they know the Jacobites are done for. The shiz has hit the fan. So he and Jocasta and Morna, their aim is to go for America. So they are bound at this time when they were in the carriage, they were bound for the estates of their other daughters who were already married. Hector, and this is interesting. This is interesting because this is no proof that they're going to leave it out. Okay. But, and so I don't want to say too much, but I think we're past the point. Well, okay. It could be filled in later, like at the end of this, of the series, end of the season, because we're not getting it right now. I think something has to be said because it looks like it's a change. And if it's a change that's done, we can talk about the book because it's no longer a spoiler. Hector, she says, had stolen a case of gold arrived from France too late for the battle. Now, we're given no information of how he had stolen it, or where he got it, etc. It's not necessarily so important at this point in the story. It does become important later. To me, as far as cohesiveness and sticking with the book, as far as like major plot points, the fact that he has the case of gold is all we need to know, right? And the fact that it made it to the New World is all we need to know. Mm-hmm. However, it is a change. And again, maybe I'm wrong and it'll end up not being a change. So for those of us who went through our Fiery Cross read-along, you guys will know what we're talking about. We talked about this ad nauseum, or probably me as usual. And you will get what we're talking about. Those of you who are show watchers only may not understand. And I'm going to say as much as I can without potentially spoiling other things. But in the book, at least, it is not stolen. There were, if I'm not mistaken, there were three cases of gold, carts, cases, whatever, of this Frenchman's gold, the King Louis gold, which was meant, Bonnie Prince Charlie, to help with the cause. It did arrive too late. Now, I won't say who the final person was, because partly because I'm not 100% sure. And also, if I were sure, I don't want to necessarily spoil something that actually they could be bringing in. But in the book, there were three people who met to split up the gold. One was Hector Cameron. One was, who's the other one we know of, Sam? Remember?
Dougal,
exactly. So the other was Dougal, which should not be a surprise because, yeah, the whole Dougal and I wonder if What's-Her-Nuts knew about it or knew it might be coming. She probably did. But anyway, Galus. So there were three of them. We know of two of them from the book. In the show, they haven't mentioned anything. And of course, it's possible. Well, we don't know the timeline. The show's timeline is wonky town. They're never really, I'm not going to say they're purposely shady, but I guess they are. When you have deleted tweets, it's purposely shady. But whatever, it has not been explained to us, right? When they were on that carriage ride, let alone, although that I think is easier to guess because by that point they already had the gold. But also it's not explained to us exactly when this gold, how it was found, how it was stolen, where it was taken. So in the book, it's three people split up the gold to hold it in case for whatever to try and use when they can or when it comes up. And the reason I think it's going to come back, hopefully, is because in the book, do you guys remember when Jamie escapes from, Jamie is out with the people in the wilderness, right? Like
when they're doing the peat, they're cutting the peat.
Yeah, doing the peat. So when they're doing labor, right? Prison labor.
Well, they're allowed to cut the peat to keep themselves warm.
Fair enough. Yes. So when they're out there, so they're taken out, they have labor. They do labor during the day, like I think it's 12 hours a day, or at least sunrise to sunset, and they're taken back. Well, one of those days, if you guys remember from season three, right? He escapes. Oh, sorry, I missed a part. He is taken by Lord John because of his language ability. Lord John asks Jamie to go with him to be an interpreter. The soldiers who had found him, he had said something about gold, and that was what had interested Lord John, because Lord John was like, I'm a brand new governor out here. You know, it's kind of out in the wilderness. It's like, it's not high in the totem pole of assignments. So I really want to make my mark and get some kudos from my upper king people or people in higher places, higher ranks.
My upper king people.
Yes, Summer. The king is higher than him. Okay. People like the king, whatever. Higher than him.
My upper king people.
He thought, oh my gosh, if there's a way, because at this point, we're not told of any kind of king's gold, and he doesn't know it, but there's mention of gold. He takes him, Jamie does his job, but he doesn't tell him everything. He does mention something about the gold, but he doesn't mention all the things about
the White Witch.
Yeah, the White Witch. So, of course, Jamie thinking, oh my gosh, is it possibly Claire? Jamie like doesn't really give a rat's about the gold or any jewels or any kind of treasure. So Duncan Kerr. That's the dude's name, I think, the one who dies. So anyway, Jamie hears this. He tells Lord John what he tells him, and he shortly thereafter runs away. He escapes and goes on a walkabout and willingly comes back. Of course, he didn't find Claire. He did find the jewels, right? If I'm not mistaken, didn't find gold. He found those jewels, and I mean, there may have been some gold in there, but he found the stuff on the island. He brought back at least the sapphire. And we know the rest of it. In the book, when we learn of this from Jocasta, there is a connection made pretty firmly between the Frenchman's gold that is mentioned by Duncan Kerr, that Jamie learns about, that Lord John learns about, and we learn that there were three men. Now, Jocasta, I don't know if one, I think, wore a mask. Jocasta didn't know one of them. She knew Duncan. Excuse me, Duncan. She knew Dougal, her brother, and she knew Hector. Of course, she was trusted with it because she was Dougal's sister and Hector's wife. So anyway, that's how she knew about it, in the book at least. And here he has stolen it. I don't know if that is something that is a story she's sticking to, if it's what Hector told her, or, I mean, it's probably in her best interest to stick to that story if that's what their cover story was. But anyway, long talk short, we learned that he had stolen this gold. So it'll be interesting to see how they develop the rest of the story. And I will say this, in the book, it is a decently important storyline that takes us through book 8. That's all I'm going to say. So it's kind of important. Thank the baby Jesus. They kept it in some capacity. We'll learn more. I'm actually very excited about this. So what I wrote was, because we don't know, apparently Hector had no help and was no help, and maybe there weren't three men, or there's just so much. There's just so much. We don't know if they're going to connect it to Duncan Kerr or not. So they make it, obviously, they leave her daughter, and Jocasta is telling this to Murta. They make it to the States. They're not States yet. They make it to the New World. They make it to the colonies. And she says that she has spent 30 years in the place made by the gold that took her daughter from her. And we learn her other daughters, remember, to whom they were on their way to. And this is how she knows it, because they made it there and she saw it happen. Their daughters died in the fires. And she's like, I knew that if we didn't get there in time, that the government troops, the Redcoats, were going, Cumberland namely, they were going to kill everyone or burn them out of their homes. They were not going to treat anyone who was left kindly. And indeed, both of her daughters died in those fires. So because of this, of course, she has suffered unbelievably. And so what sort of man is she looking for? Or does she want, if she goes with a man? She wants a man she doesn't want his sort of man. Murta is the type of man who will lose everything for what he believes in. And she says she will not give her heart to this sort of man again. Now, she actually already has. That's why she's in pain. But right. She means go all the way as far as, you know, joining in marriage, or at least stay with him. And she gives him back his gift. So this was his chance. He had one more chance. He still would have had the law after him. But if he had promised right then and there to give things up, I believe she would have said yes. She would have helped hide him until things blew over and the governor left for New York. I mean, there's so much that maybe could have happened, but again, we would have been stuck with Murta. So, and we got to kill him. So but would you agree, Summer, that this was his last chance?
I guess. I mean, I just think he made everything worse. Like, she'd resigned herself to moving on with the things. And she, you know, had her head set on what she was going to do, and the path was laid out in front of her. She's agreed to it. That's her decision. She's made peace. And then he's going to show up the night before her wedding and be like, I didn't think you'd actually go through with it. You should stay with me instead. But, you know, just wait until this whole thing, you know, levels out. I don't know what he thought he was actually going to accomplish. Like, it was a move. And I think it was way, way too late. And like I said, all he really did was ruin her wedding day.
And he tells her, I love you, Jocasta. The world may change, but that will never change. But what he doesn't say, but which is also true, is that he will not change for her, because he is absolutely the type, because he's going along with the whole regulator thing, right? That's his cause. And I'm not poo-pooing him for a cause. But he is a man who will lose everything for what he believes in. So the way he puts that cause above his love for her.
I mean, that's all he does. Put causes ahead of himself.
Yeah. So just as Jamie chose pride over love because he had gotten those rings from Claire and it was, you know, not a pretty sight. Just as Jamie chooses pride over love, Murta has chosen his cause or principle over love. Which actually is, to me, better than pride over love.
Pride is like self-centered. Pride is not about anybody else. It's just about you. Yeah.
I agree. So Claire goes out to the stable after dark to have some cuddles with Lucas. And this is where a drunk Jamie finds her.
Drunk Jamie's my new favorite Jamie. Drunk Jamie says everything that everyone else has been saying about Claire since season one, which is you say and do too much. You're still only a woman. You know, you're not in the time period. Like it was like every argument that you and I have ever had about Claire not shutting up and Claire going too far and Claire not doing what a typical woman should
you
do.
And I don't think you and I argue about that.
Well,
I don't think we argue about that. I think we agree.
But we may argue against other people together. We could argue together, but not against each other, sure.
Yeah, fair enough. So he says that there's cause to celebrate and she is still but hurt. Understandably, I would be too, because again, he chose pride over their love in that instance. And she says, quote, "I didn't think there was anything else Bonnet could take from us." And then also she says, "I'm condemning you for letting your hatred of Bonnet come between us." So I think until right now, and maybe not even 100% now, I think he is seeing it more now, but he's a little bit or a lot of bit drunky. So I don't think he can fully see it for real now, but he definitely sees more, realizing, like, you know, he never says I'm sorry. But as a matter of fact, he turns his conversation around and look, woman, you do whatever you want, whatever the circumstances. Sometimes you need reminding. Mm-hmm. Don't forget, you're still a woman.
Dude.
Now, yeah. Okay. So Summer is thinking about that. And this is her favorite Jamie. It's borderline my favorite Jamie. My favorite Jamie is Jamie with, I know it's not 100% long, but it's longer. But Jamie with long hair with a little bit coming down.
Dude. I literally took notes that were like, looks like his hair is finally coming out of that ponytail, Ginger.
Yeah, that's too funny. Oh my God. Yes. So you are on my wavelength.
Uh-huh.
Someone reminded me, and I don't know if it was on our live last week or maybe one of the ladies in Oregon last week. I don't know. It was in the last week or two. Someone reminded me that in the promo shot we get when Jamie's like standing out there half naked, cut with like, you know, blood on his, like, you know, blood on him a little bit.
In the river.
Yeah. So that scene, someone reminded me that his hair is down then and it's wet. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's so right. We're going to get it. We're going to get it. So I'm looking forward to that. And I think just because we know, okay, we have not seen the episode, we cannot promise or prove it's going to happen. But knowing the architecture of the season and how this big bad Tingle Wingus is about to happen, the big bad Tingle Wingus.
You should stop them.
Has to happen in the next episode or two to have enough time for the rest of the season to happen. Because in the book, this big bad Tingle Wingus was like maybe 2/3 of the way through, not quite halfway, but maybe 2/3, maybe a little bit less. And it definitely was the climax.
Book readers, just check out the title on IMDb, The Ballad of Roger Mack.
Next episode is going to be it's going to be the big bad Tingle Wingus. I can say that right now. But before that big bad Tingle Wingus happens, Jamie and his long hair has to happen because it's in the order of what happens in the book. And if they're going to keep it, which they did, it's going to happen before the other thing happens. So I love their love theme in these lighter sounds. It was kind of playful. It was kind of playful, but it was pretty, but playful, like very kind of lighter instruments. Now, what did you think about that scene, Summer? I thought it was quite a scene. It was cute, but like how was it cute? It was good.
I thought I was confused that it was just turning into a giant kissing competition.
Well, they got down to it, but
oh, they did.
I am now kind of confused.
But then I was concerned because he was like, look down and watch me take you. And I'm like, there are way too many clothes for her to look down and see anything. Because in the book, she was in a nightgown or a nightdress and it was, you know, thinner. And you could probably swipe that out of the way, but you can't swipe her whole dress and all of the under things out of the way. And there's absolutely no way that he could have gotten straight to her lady bits.
It had the potential to be a very hot line, but it was kind of silly because of all the clothing. So I'm guessing this was not the scene that they were talking about when in the press they did. I don't think it was at the premiere on stage, and it definitely wasn't us when on the red carpet or anything. To someone, I think Sam mostly said it, but I think Katrina was standing next to him. Without giving, because we haven't seen anything, so we don't know. But without giving, without giving anything away, he says, "Yep, that's right. We went there. Yes, we did." Katrina was like, "Yep." And so I'm like, this was not that scene. Whatever it was, it can't have been that scene.
If they went there, it was purely on that line alone.
I mean, again, which kind of sounds silly because all the clothes.
Right. No, I don't disagree.
They cuddle in the barn and he gives her back her two rings. Claire was right. He says he's not doing this for Bree. He, selfishly, understandably, needs to see it done. And she says, "Promise me that Stephen Bonnet will never take another thing from us again."
Yep.
And he gives her back the rings.
But he now has whiskey partners, right? So he's procured the intro to Bonnet. He's him and Wiley. That was the whole thing, wasn't it? And then I wrote, "Mr. Malcolm, the smuggler returns."
So somewhere else in Wilmington, perhaps, we're not told exactly where, unless I missed a screenshot somewhere. Mr. Forbes has quickly left River Run and gone somewhere else, and he is having coffee with Bonnet.
Who I wrote, he was the dandy psychopath.
Stop it. I wrote, he's almost a dandy.
But a dandy psychopath.
What is this, Summer? You got in my brain.
I don't know.
Bonnet makes, I will say one thing for Bonnet. He is an equal opportunity make everyone uncomfortabler, whatever. Maker of people uncomfortable. Is that better? Forbes is reporting to him from River Run.
How does Forbes know that Jemmy is his son?
I wonder if...
Did Bonnet say something?
I kind of doubt he may have. We don't know, I don't think. My guess is that there's some knowledge of... Well, wasn't Forbes there at the dinner when Jocasta was trying to find a husband for Brianna, a pregnant Brianna?
He absolutely was, but at no time did they ever say that Bonnet was the father then, because as far as they knew, it was this Roger dude.
No. No, that's not what I'm saying. But there was no Roger dude in the picture at that point in her life, but no one had seen him.
Yeah, but not physically. But she said that she had another man and he was missing and, you know, they were looking for him. So, I mean, it was never that she never talked about being with Bonnet.
Okay, so my guess is, reflecting back, it probably has to be Bonnet who said something. Because if you remember a few weeks ago at the Hoor boxing ring, Bonnet says, "I'm a father now." He may not have been speaking to Forbes, but he was. He said it there. He may not have been speaking to Forbes, but Forbes was there with him. So my guess is, if he and Forbes are like that, you know, that close, that they're having coffee together. My guess is, number one, he wasn't hiding the fact that he was a father. And he probably told Forbes that it was his son, that Brianna. He knows everyone. He knows Jocasta.
And Forbes was really well aware of his prior dealings with the Frasers, because he mentioned it. He goes, "Oh, I saw the Frasers there." So, I mean, he knows more than Book Forbes did, for sure.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. And so he tells him, "Your son is now the proud owner of River Run." Huh. Well, that gives Bonnet a reason to show up at some point in the future, doesn't it? They've opened that door.
Well, I mean, it does, but he's the future owner of River Run, which means he still has to go and kill Jocasta, because Jocasta is...
Not future, proud owner, current owner. But it's going to be held. It's like a regency, but it's not a kingship. So yeah, she will be running it until Jeremiah comes into his certain age, if not majority.
Yeah, but she is, it's in trust while she's still alive.
Back to River Run. The governor is upset that no one gave themselves up. And I was just like, you're stupid.
Back to the governor, back in his uniform.
You are stupid. And he says, so we'll have our war after all. Meet me in Hillsborough in a fortnight. Go get your militia and meet me there. And then, like, wow, that escalated. And my final comments were, here we go.
Make sure the thrush is there.
Oh, Lord. And they haven't even called him the thrush yet, have they?
No, and they probably won't at this point. I said my last note was Hillsborough's back on. Oh, good grief.
Oh, my gosh. Well, it's not Hillsborough. It will end up being, if they keep it, because at least to the big things that are physically,
Alamance.
Yeah, it'll be the Battle of Alamance. You guys can go look it up. I promise you, Roger, Jamie, and them, they're not in it. They're fictional. But it was a real battle. We shared the link to the Wikipedia article about it several weeks ago because we were talking about Hillsborough and other things. Or actually, maybe I shared it when we talked about it in the book, but I think it was a few weeks ago. I'll share it again. It's interesting. So the War of Regulation, and that's what Summer and I were talking about. The War of Regulation is not a one and done thing, right? It's the process. So the War of Regulation was the whole thing from the beginning of the stirrings of a movement, of the regulation movement, up till through at least the Battle of Alamance, if I'm not mistaken. The Battle of Alamance is not the war. It's part of the war, but it is what at least was portrayed in the book. So you can read about that, the historical part, not necessarily the book if you don't want to spoil things. So that was like hecka quick. They brought that in. So our guess is it's going to be next week. Awesome.
Well, they did title next week's episode, The Ballad of Roger Mack. So if you read the books, you know what's coming. And that being said, that was episode 506. Join us next week when we will be discussing episode 507, entitled, as I just said, The Ballad of Roger Mack. And if you'd like to join us to continue the conversation, you can join us at www.outlanderpod.com/groups.
And again, a special thanks. I'm trying to go Irish for some reason.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
Exactly. A special thanks to this episode's co-producer, Anna L. To find out more about how you can support us on Patreon and even potentially become a co-producer, visit outlanderpod.com/Patreon. So thank you as always so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. And until then, stay home. Wash your ding-dong hands. Be safe. We wish you peace and health. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.